Is it the floor's back to me here? Okay. Let me move the mic then, because I'm gonna get all Pro Tools on you here. Where's the speakers? I want to make sure I'm not. Okay, it's over there, so we're not threatening an immense squeal. So I've got an example here of multiple miking. I had the band Windhand was in the studio with me, and this album actually it came out on Relapse Records. It's actually charting right now. It's like, you know, somewhere in the bottom of the top 100 albums or whatever, and it's appeared on a bunch of random Billboard charts for various niche genres, you know, because it's a heavy rock album. But for it to appear at all is actually, Relapse Records is super happy that it even, you know, is selling. So, and the band is touring, and they're pretty nice people. They're from Virginia. And this is funny. I have four different examples of various things here. One, the band is from, Virginia is a band from Japan, two bands from California. Strangely enough, I don't have any Seattle examples. Whatever. So, Windhand. Let me see. Missing a few plugins, so the vocals are kind of buried, because I think there's something that I don't have the dongle for here. But anyway, you get the idea. These speakers are not the best way of showing it, but I'm going to show you what I did. Oh, come on. Silly Pro Tools. There we go. So he had a modified Orange amp. Now, you can tell it's like major distortion. This is a heavy riff band. It's like Black Sabbath with a female singer. But she's got this kind of witchy, ethereal thing that she does on top of the music, which is pretty unique. It's really cool, and it kind of draws you in, unlike the usual, like, gruff macho metal vocal, which is pushing you away. You know, it's a whole different approach. They're really cool, and they're actually doing really well right now. My wife loves this band. He had this amp, this like big, heavy sort of sounding thing, and then I said, well, all right, that's all right, but let's use one of my amps too, you know, this kind of thing we were just talking about. So I put two mics on his amp. I have one up close and one that was about 20 inches out from his 4x12. And then I had my other amp, which was actually a Sovtek MIG 60, which I modified myself. That's another story. I'm very into like hacking my own guitar amps. This is old school technology, these guitar amps. I basically, everything I know about guitar amps, I learned from the Radiotron Designer's Handbook, which I think is like, what, 1942?
1954.
54, is it, the last version of it?
Yeah.
It's a wonderful book.
The big red one.
Yeah, I've got the hardcover black one. It's probably older.
I'll talk to you later, I'll get you the red one.
Oh, that's, all right, yeah, it's like, be beautiful.
And you can find it in PDF online.
I know, all these old RCA
books.
But it's
not as cool as having the
book. No, I like having the book, you know. Yeah, this is great because you open the book and you realize that most of these classic guitar amp circuits were, you know, they're based on circuits that were in this RCA. It's like a handbook of tube amp design from the World War II era. And you look inside and it's, oh, there it is. That's almost a Fender Twin right there on page 34. And, you know, that science, and there's all sorts of weird, obscure knowledge that's in those books that, you know, they don't teach that stuff at the UW. Even when I was in college in the late 70s, you know, they barely taught audio at that point. It was all about, you know, AND gates and digital and whatnot. The computer thing was on the way, and, you know, you had to be on board with that. So I had everything I know about analog, and particularly tubes, I had to learn on my own. But the information is out there. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. I had my amp and I had his amp. His amp, I have two different mics. So I'll show you what they were. So this is one. That's the close mic. Now this is the mic. Oh, come on, you. Okay, I have to disable the group here. Hang on. Okay, good. Here's the distant mic. Close mic. Distant mic. And I have no EQ on these at all. It's hard to tell. Standing here, I can hear the low end coming off the speaker. The close mic has a little more low end. The Distin mic is a little thinner. Now, I've got the time adjuster plug-in on here, and the time adjuster plug-in basically allows you to choose a delay of, say, you can get down to the sample level with a delay, so it's useful when you're lining things up. I'm going to bypass these right now, and we're going to just hear the raw signal. Now I'm going to put them both on. Okay, that's comb filtering, because one mic was 20 inches out from the other. It sounds kind of hollow and scooped out. The signals are not lining up. Now, the interesting thing here is, let me put this back on. When the time adjuster plugin is enabled, disabled. Now with 121 samples of delay applied to the close mic, which basically delays the signal enough to arrive at the same time as the signal that reaches the mic that's 21 inches away. 121 samples at 96K with sound traveling 1,100 feet per second. You know, I don't know what it is, but apparently, whatever that is, it's about the delay time between that takes sound about this to travel this far. And the way you can get this is you take the pedal, or you take the plug-in, flip it out of phase. And you slide it around. Until it phase cancels perfectly. It's right around there. Oh, come on, you. There's the null point where they're as out of phase as they're going to get, because the signals are not identical. The mic at a distance is hearing a different sound, but you can hear enough of the fundamental getting canceled. Now when I flip it back in phase, it's huge. And the sound is a lot more interesting than either of them by itself. Now when I combine that with the other amp, now the other amp is not as interesting. It's kind of a little ratty sort of sound. It's similar because he was using a distortion pedal, actually, so it kind of limits the difference. But nonetheless, the amp has a different character. The speaker cabinet had a different character. And again, let me take the time adjuster pedals and turn them off. So there's three different mics, three different setups. I've got three different, drastically different tones, actually, with the same performance. Now, if I put them all on, without doing this time adjuster thing, if pedals, the time adjuster plugins are all blue, it's cool, but if I enable them all, so, and I pretty much empirically went through these and found the delay settings that worked. Oh, come on, dang it. Sorry, I'm so used to it. Okay, and the sum total of the three sounds is this. Now that's actually, considering the amount of distortion that's being employed here, that is actually a very enharmonic sound, because that sound could easily just collapse into just horrible noise. And that's part of the trick, is knowing how to set the controls on the amp and how to EQ the other instruments to fit what the guitar amps are doing. You know, you have to give the kick drum this crazy clicky sort of scooped out sound because the mid-range is all being occupied by the guitar. In fact, vocals and guitar are taping up the whole mid-range, and you've got like the bass and the kick drum down here at like 50 hertz, 100 hertz, and you've got the cymbals and the sizzly stuff up here, and the mid-range is where everything else lives.
Can you solo the kick for us?
I could. Oh, sorry, this thing is... I'm used to the mouse going and scrolling in the other direction. It always drives me crazy when it's like this. Ah, come on. There we go. Ah, not the whole kit. There we go. The reverb pedal, or the reverb plugins are on solo bypass right now, so you're hearing it with effects. That's the close mic.
Let me disable the groups here. So I have the solos on, XOR, so they theoretically they should go from one to another, but I keep forgetting the groups are enabled.
There's the close mic. There's the outside mic on the kick, which is useful, again, if it's lined up reasonably.
Can you show the EQ for the scoop?
Huh?
Can you show the EQ for the scoop?
I can. It's very drastic. Actually, it isn't that drastic. Look at that. I must have done some EQ on the way in that case. That's the close mic EQ. It isn't as drastic as it is sometimes. But you know what? I track through a Trident console, and generally for the kick and the toms, I just know exactly what I want. I just kind of, okay, let's record. You know, and then, you know, the digital EQ is better for solving problems or for general flavor. Here's the snare. Super thin, but it cuts through that guitar. Anyway, this is not a drum clinic, but it's... So that's an example of, like, you know, taking what could be a dreadful guitar tone and with miking and phase alignment and so forth and just being really careful about the knobs on the amp. I mean, I had to go in there with... You know, and stick my face in front of the jet engine actually for a few minutes to set the sound actually, and you know, wait like a couple minutes for my ears to quit ringing, but it's part of the charm of the job.
Jack.
Yes.
What does it mean where your destinations say tape on?
Ah. In this case. And this is something I do because Soundhouse has got a Studer 827 2-inch 24 track that is still functional. And one of the things I like to do if I have enough time and, you know, and I don't mind screwing around with it is I will Y the kick drum, the snare drum, and the toms both digitally into the Pro Tools session and over to the 2-inch machine and come off the repro head and also go into the same Pro Tools session on another set of tracks down at the bottom of the screen. And they're muted because they're coming back delayed because it's the time the tape takes to go between the record and the playback head. But I don't have to deal with SMPTE or syncing or any of that stuff. Later on, I just go down and I just like, okay, here's the kick on the digital one. Here's the one that went to tape and came back and was recorded at the same time. Let's just nudge them in so they line up. And you can get them exactly sample for sample lined up very easily if you do that, if you're recording and playback at the same time as you're recording the song. And then I have like the sort of squashed analog, because this is, I always preferred to use analog tape at 15 inches per second because I prefer the tone of it. I don't like 30 IPS, and that's another discussion. I'm so glad analog tape is gone. Except once in a while, I like to take out one of my old reels of GP9 that I've been using for 15 years and put it on the 2-inch machine and get that squashed drum sound that you can get by pegging the meters with the kick and the snare and the toms specifically. I don't do it with the cymbals. I don't even bother with guitars, vocals, anything. At this point, those percussive things are the things that are affected the most by how analog tape affects the signal, and it's pretty drastic. Analog tape is not subtle. Once you're used to digital recording, you go back to analog, you'll lose your mind because nothing comes back the way it went in. And you realize that 20, 30 years ago, we didn't know any better. We just, oh, that's tape. That's what it sounds like. Isn't that nice? And now I think, what an imperfect recording medium this was, because I got the sound exactly the way I want it, and now it's come back and it's completely different. So, and there's the whole tape hiss and all that stuff. But with a band like this, there's no holes in it, so you're not going to hear the tape hiss. So that's a kind of a nice thing I like to do sometimes if I have the time. And these guys had the budget. I had 2 weeks to make the record, which is super deluxe these days. That's plush. That's just like, you know, I get a whole 5 days to mix it. Oh, my God. So I have both rack tape, rack tom top and bottom. I ended up not using the top digital. Anyway, this is all
somewhat irrelevant. Let me get out of this session.
Anyway, this was a fun one. So let me go to some of the other things that happen that are not good. Sometimes people send me things to mix, and I was not there when they tracked it. And I wish I had been there, because I would have stopped them. So sometimes I get a guitar tone that is like, hold on a second, let me see what's, darn, this thing is scrolling the wrong way again. It makes me crazy. I always have my mouse in the other direction. Okay, sometimes I get a session, and here's what it sounds like. Now that is the EQ'd sound. Here's what it actually sounded like. Okay. There's painful. Perfect, but not perfect enough. There are things specifically wrong with this, and I'm going to show you specific components that are non-musical, and it's going to hurt your ears a little bit. I'm going to show you how I do this. And in this case, good heavens, I have two different plugins in series here. We're getting pretty deluxe here. Okay, there's my EQ curve that I applied. All of that in an effort to try and dig out the music that was buried in all this white noise. Because there is music there, right? Sitting there in the mid-range, there's some fundamental frequencies. And you got to get the crap that's mixed in out of the way. And I'll show you how you find that. It's very easy. It's kind of painful, and I always have to warn people. Let me turn the volume down.
First, let me disable a few things here. So, let's put this back. So I'm going to remember, 3.14, 4.69. Okay, so here's my sound.
So what this has is it's got a fierce couple of fierce spikes in the frequency response. And this is characteristic of a lot of tube circuits. It's characteristic of a lot of guitar pickups. And when it's going through crazy amplification, there are... Now, the classical players have this thing when they're playing cello. They call it a wolf tone, which is like a place where you hit a note and the thing suddenly goes... And there's like a resonance that pops up, like one note is louder than the others. And... guitars have the same thing. It's very typical of a lot of, like, Tellys have this. Certain kinds of amps make this. So I hear this immediately, and I go, okay, what's the horrible non-musical component that I need to get rid of? Let's find it. Here's how I look for it. So what I'll do is I'll set a horrible peak like this. I'll move it up and down until it hurts me. I just found the death frequency that's in this guitar. So now we just flip it to minus 15 dB. And the interesting thing about it is you don't realize that it's there until you remove it. You hear it? It's like a whistle. I'm standing a foot from the speaker here. I don't know if you're getting the same dramatic effect that I am from here. So that was one. And of course, there's more. I'm listening to it, and I'm hearing like, okay, there's another one here. There's some horrible non-musical thing here. Let's find it. It's there.
Yeah, I know.
My ears are ringing and I can't answer them.
So now I've scooped that out.
So here it is in my bypass mode. So you can see the non-musical components that I have removed. Because that is not musical. It's not harmonic. It has no emotional content. It has no musical content. It's uncorrelated white noise. It's not even white noise. It's just uncorrelated crap. It does nothing for the signal. It makes it impossible to listen to. You turn it up and it hurts. And everybody goes, why isn't the guitar louder? Well, because it hurts my ears. Okay, and then I look at it and I go, all right, well, let's see what else I need to do. What do you know? There was another one that I found, I think. There it is. There's another one. Scoop. Now, the other thing you can do is you can get rid of everything above 5 or 6K with an electric guitar. Generally, there's nothing musical going on above 5K. It's just, it's crap. If it's a clean tone, you might be hearing like nice harmonics and pick noise and so forth. But this kind of guitar, there's nothing musically useful up there. So you can see that I've completely like... I've just taken it out. And you can't really tell the difference. Unless I get kind of drastic. But you know, at least I'm staying away from the Nyquist limit. There's that. So, and then lastly I go, all right, you know what? There's mid-range here that is musical. Let me see if I can find it. It's a super noisy band with four mics on their drums. There wasn't much I could do with it. But anyway, there's an example of like worst-case scenario. But yet, you do this thing and you can sort of zero in. Let me give you some slightly kinder examples. Let's see. Okay, here's a good one. This was kind of drastic, but it's a totally different tone. In this case, I think I'm missing a couple plugins. We'll see how it works. Okay. This was, again, a record that I didn't record. It was sent to me to mix. So there's the stock, the tone as it existed on the recording. So you can hear the low end that is somewhat uncorrelated and somewhat useless in terms of value in the mix because that... There's a low-end woofy thing here that would be fighting with your kick drum, it'd be fighting with your bass, it would be fighting with the low end of the vocals. It just basically would be clouding up the whole bottom couple octaves of the mix. And you've got those spikes. So let's look at the EQ here. Bam! There it is. So, now, that's the sound that I ended up as sounding the best in context with the drums and the bass that were... Take the EQ off, it's there, but the music is kind of going away. So, and we can explore this for a moment if we wish to. Where is the solo? Okay, there's that one. Another one here. Hard to listen to this, I know. And then the low end was here. So, some of the stuff I have to deal with because this is like thoroughly non-musical stuff. There's one last one. I'll give you one that's a little kinder. It's a blues tune. This is a player named Debbie Davies, actually. And I think this is what I have here. Okay. Here's the tone that I was presented with.
Now that's EQ'd. There it is without the EQ. In this case, the wolf tone is here. Hear it? Back in. Again, it's a specific, it's almost like an oscillator. You can hear it as like a specific whistle. It almost has a, you could almost figure out, if I had a frequency sweep, I could probably find exactly what the frequency is. It's, this thing says it's 2.42 kilohertz. And this is what you were going to mention, is like, it's a standard thing. Now, okay, the thing that makes it doubly painful is the, this is not the time to explain the Fletcher-Munson curves, which are frequency response curves which describe the sensitivity of human hearing to different frequencies. And one of the areas in which the human hearing range is most sensitive is around 2K, because it's like, you know, it makes it easy to understand speech. Well, for whatever reason, guitars, amps, pickups, distortion, all this stuff, this whole signal chain seems to have a habit of emphasizing 2.5K, which I call the pain frequency. It's the ice pick in the eardrum frequency. And a lot of times you run into this and, you know, you think, I want to turn the guitars up, but the mix hurts. And you find, you just have to find these things. So I'm going to get out of here. You get the idea. Some of the stuff you have to do with. Now, here's the last thing I'm going to show you. This is a set. This is a set of, I did a microphone shootout using one tone. At the top of the screen there is, it's grayed out now, but it's a direct signal, as I was telling you. It's a direct signal of me just playing a riff, and then I think it even says it right there. Reference DI signal, reamped through Rat and Fender. And then I had a speaker, and I tried to match up these different mics. So first, there's like a selection of SM57s. Let me do a loop here so you're hearing the same thing over and over. This is going to be interesting because you're going to hear like 30 different mics placed at the same place on the same speaker with the same signal coming out of them. So it's as close to a perfect removing other variables other than the mic itself as I could get it. Loop playback. Okay, there we go. I see I have a note there that says lower output than other 57s. I had 7 different SM57s, and I was like, what's the difference between these? There wasn't that much difference. Here's the Beta 58. It's a louder signal. There are 2 different Beta 58s I had that didn't sound the same. One of them is definitely a little more shrill. So I marked the one that I preferred. Now here's like some standard 58s. Oddly enough, the brand new one was actually the one with the lowest signal level. That's an old one. That's a brand new one, which actually is kind of the mushiest one. I think my oldest one is actually USA made and has the 2 impedances on it. Anyway, so just going on, this is one of those days when I had like some time to kill. Again, using the studio as a laboratory. Okay, here's a Beta 57. Here's a Beta 56. Almost the same. Here's a Shure 565, and I boosted it 12 dB because it was super low output. Oh, this was only 2 or 3 dB. Now, here's the Shure PE588 that I boosted 12 dB. This is the old Unidyne Shure with the little silver capsule and the little switch on it.
Shure mid-range, it could be useful if you don't mind boosting the signal. Okay. Now we're into a bunch of 421s.
I've got seven 421s here. Two of them are the, let's see, seven old ones.
And they're all different. The differences are pretty subtle, though. That mic is fairly consistent. Now here's the 421-2, which is the one you buy now if you try to buy a 421. Here's an RE20. Here's the RE27, which is the supposedly hi-fi version.
RE20. RE27.
I usually end up not using that RE27 on anything because it's just something a little tinny about it. It's just a little, there's some sort of shrill thing that I've never really liked. Okay, here's a Beyer M200. Which is a popular mic on snare. A little darker.
Jack?
Yeah?
Are you sure you don't mean 201 for the
Beyer? No, it's a 200. It's actually not the 201. It's actually a 200, and I have never been able to find out any information about it.
Omni.
The 200?
Yeah.
You can't even... Beyer doesn't even have anything on the website about it.
It's very hard to find them.
Yeah, it's all metal. It's like a terrible design, because it's kind of like that original Beta 57, where you can kind of go bring on the metal shell of it, you know, and you think, that was an oversight. But it's actually a useful guitar mic. I got it for, like, you know... $50 at the Trading Musician. Nobody knew what it was. No, the M201 is not in this test. I got it later. That's the one that everybody loves on snare. It works very well for that. No, the M200 is just a weird oddball mic. And I have an M300, which has got the ball thing. And
it's kind of like their version of the 58. Here's a PPA ribbon.
Super boomy.
That was, here's a Royer.
Also lots of proximity effect.
So the ribbons, you know, they've got their thing. That's an RE20. There's a Royer. Here's an RCA 74B from the backside. It's just kind of nice. It's not shrill. Here's an RCA BK5B. And I wrote a note here that says distorts horribly. Say that because I looked at the waveform and it's kind of square wave. That's a really old mic. It's kind of odd. Okay, and then I've got some condensers at the bottom of the page here. 4040. Let's see. 33. Another 4033. An AKG 460. Surprisingly dark. An SM81. ATM 11, an electric condenser, and here's a U87, and here's a different one, surprisingly dark. So, you know, here's a PV mic, a different AKG, here's what I'm, this one just says mystery mic, this one also says mystery mic. This one's an Altec mystery mic. This one is a Radio Shack Omni that I got at Desert Industries. Surprisingly good for $20. And then this is a D112.
That was all of them at once. Okay, there's the D112. That's the egg-shaped kick drum mic. So that's enough of that anyway. You're tired of hearing that riff. But I don't know how much you can tell from, like, you know, 50 feet away from these little Alesis monitors. But the point is the same signal. And it's harder to tell with pure tones the differences between mics. But as soon as you introduce full spectrum white noise, it's really obvious what the differences are between different microphones. It becomes incredibly obvious because you're comparing, like, a sound that covers the whole frequency range. You can just go, oh, yeah, that one's got a little spike there. This one's woofy. And so, you know, whatever. I'm that kind of a madman that I would actually spend an entire afternoon doing this.
That's outstanding, Jack.
Now, I'll tell you another thing that I figured out. if you really want to do this right, you've got to lay the cabinet on its back. And if you really want to do it right, you want to have a single 12 cabinet laid on its back. And you want to put the mics, you can put the mics. I've had it where I put the mics around it in a circle. Like I'll put like six SM58s in a circle around it and then kind of go, all right, now that's, they're all like aligned. All right, yeah, they're all equal. Okay, now, and then you can really like just immediately just go, oh yeah, this mic's a little quieter. One thing I found by doing that, I took a 4x12 cab, laid it on its back, and put some fairly, I found the ones that were kind of matched, like there were like two or three mics that are like practically identical, and I sort of placed them in different places on this 4x12 cab. I took one speaker, and I thought, let's put one out here, kind of on the corner, and let's put another one in here toward the middle of the cabinet, and then one, so I had them actually the same geometric orientation to, in a circular sense, they were all in the same orientation to the speaker, but they were in different orientations to the square cabinet. And what I found was that if you can imagine this as a 4x12, and this is the side of the 4x12, and so just imagine you're seeing two more speakers here where I'm standing. I have mic here, mic here, mic here, mic here. Interestingly enough, the mic that sounded the best at getting a good sound from the speaker was the mic that was out here on the corner. And I realized that if the mic's here, it's getting out of phase stuff into the back of the mic from the other speakers. Mm-hmm. Here, at least, they're all going to be, even though there's some time smearing, they're all in phase. You're getting the same, you're getting signals that are all more or less lined up. So if you're ever miking, now whenever I mic a 4x12 cabinet, I always pick a corner, and I do this with one of my mics, as opposed to putting one, say here or whatever, because I did that experiment and it was completely obvious when I did it. Where was the place to put it? So I don't have much else, but I've got a bonus thing here that I'm going to show you. And this is the bonus. The bonus is a guitar that is in a non-Western scale. We were talking about tuning a little bit earlier, and I went down the rabbit hole on tuning and discovered that in the Western 12-tone scale, certain intervals are very harmonic and nice, and certain ones are not. So I thought, let's do the math on this. And one of the things, the number 1.059, as I've said, entire civilizations have had nightmares about this number, because that is the ratio between the frequencies of adjacent notes on a guitar. 1.059 is the 12th root of 2. So to just remind everybody just quickly about how frequencies work, music works on ratios. It almost doesn't matter what the absolute number of a frequency is. What matters if you're having two different notes is the ratio between the frequencies of the notes. So when the ratio between two notes of the frequencies of two notes is 2:1, you have octaves. And let me enable this thing here for a minute. So one of the things you discover is that the intervals, the so-called fourth, which is that, I'm trying to remember, that's like 3/2. The fifth is like 4/3. The major and minor third are like 5/4, 6/5. Anyway, they're all in perfect ratios of frequencies, except that in the even-tempered 12-tone scale, the major and minor thirds are not exactly perfect fractional ratios. They're actually you would expect 1.200, which is, I think, 6/5, and instead you get 1.273 something. So in the 12-tone equal-tempered scale, some intervals are lovely and some intervals are not. So I thought, well, What if you divided the octave into more than 12 notes? Let's do the math. You know, I looked up Harry Parch, and he went there. He went down the rabbit hole with his fixed 56-tone scale. Well, the next, for a guitar, if you start dividing the octave into tinier and tinier intervals, you get frets that are so close together it's useless. So for the guitar, the next useful division of an octave into something that might be useful turned out to be a 19-tone scale. And this is back when I was really going down the rabbit hole on guitar tuning when I wrote that article. And I commissioned a friend of mine to make me a guitar that was 19 notes per octave. Of course, who do I jam with? Now, my friend Five Track is here. He has a fretless bass, and we've got plans. But now, the interesting thing about this is that if I have this guitar tuned properly, which I don't, ooh, it's settled a little. The minor third is almost perfect in this tuning. You can't tell because I don't have it tuned properly.
You have a tuner over your shoulder.
Yeah, I guess you're right. I do. Don't I? Thank you, Steve. Okay, hold on. Let me. This will be a rather. Oh, yeah, look at that. Well, I got to make sure I don't play it too hard. Do I tune to the beginning of the note or do I tune to the end of the note? Which is it going to be today? I don't know. You know, I'm going to tune more toward the beginning of the note because I'm kind of a heavy-handed, brutal pick player that wangs on the guitar. You can see what I'm doing. Come on. Oh, I should switch to my rhythm pickup. Oh, it looks like it. Oh, there it is. Isn't this exciting?
Like watching notes dry.
Yes. Now imagine how often I see people do this. Oh, hardly ever, yeah. Not often enough, let's put it that way.
Record's free, but tuning's $500.
You know, back when Facebook allowed you to have a little slogan when they first started, you'd have like a little motto, you know? And my motto in my first Facebook page was, "Why don't you tune that piece of shit?" Because it was this, you know, just the kind of thing that anybody who knows me is like, yeah, okay, that's Jack. Well, you know where to hit, you can actually play almost like a normal guitar player on this thing. But then it gets weird. So I'll leave it at that. I'm not going to try and demonstrate this because tuning it is actually a little trickier because you actually, I think only the E, the G, and the high E string in truth correspond with the actual notes on the tuner, and the others you have to do it by ear. And if you get it just exactly in tune, your chords, if you play in a lot of the places you're familiar with, you can fool people and they think you just have a slightly odd guitar until you suddenly go like one step and you do that. And it's kind of a proof of concept in a weird way, and it's fun to leave it around the studio because people randomly just sort of pick it up. And, you know, they kind of just, you know, pick it up and start noodling around on it. And then they sort of get this furrowed brow. And they're kind of going, what's up with this guitar? And I'm like, well, you know, but I will gig with it at some point. Just so to say it can be done. So, okay, I have nothing further. We've gone down the rabbit hole on guitars as much as I think I can right now. So, I don't. Should we do Q&A, Rick? I mean, is there?
It's
I mean,
10 o'clock.
Yeah, it's late.
There any, how about this? Are there any burning questions?
Burning.
I've got a burning one.
He's got it.
Burn me.
Sound like so much shit in the studio until you EQ them. How do they make it a living on the road?
How indeed.
That's your answer.
How many live audience bootlegs have you heard that sound really, 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 really good? Any? Live shows generally sound dreadful. I mean, if you have any objective way of actually, like, judging how they sound, they're horrible. The only reason you enjoy it is the whole visual spectacle and the low end shaking your chest cavity. But if you, and Janie, hello, you know this, put a stereo mic in the back of the room, it's not going to sound like a record. You know, it just doesn't. It's a big pile of just sonic crap. And that's, we're used to hearing that at live shows. It's down to the venues and the acoustics of the room and the ceiling being reflective and the walls being concrete and the floor being tile and the amps being way too loud and, you know, it's...
The mixer.
Yeah, well, the mixer's got a tough job. Look at the environment he's dealing with. You know, and then there's the old, like, can you turn your guitar amp down a little bit? No. And, you know, they kind of turn around and go like that and go, how's that? And, you know, it's exactly the same. So I don't envy live sound. I did live sound a little bit early on in my career, and I just went screaming back to the studio. And so, you know, my job is to make something that is, like, creates the illusion of a live sound. Like, and I try and get the musicians to play with the feel of a live band, which is why I don't let them use click tracks unless they're just desperate. You know, so the idea in the studio is create the illusion of a live feel without necessarily, you know, while dodging that horrible, mushy, phase-canceled, like, God knows what you're getting, live acoustics that are generally dreadful. So there's your answer. They just go out on the road anyway, and that's what it sounds like, and everyone's used to it.
Can you tell us your favorite mic placements on the cabs, and also can you comment on the acoustic placement for the mics?
What do you mean acoustic place?
Acoustic guitars.
Oh, acoustic guitars. Wait, what's that?
just quickly, wherever I put that 58.
On there
it is, I see. You put it here in the center, it's going to be shrill. You put it off center, it's going to be a little darker. You put it way off center, it's going to be really dark, but if you're dealing with a really bright amp, maybe you want that. I don't know. You know, this is kind of an EQ here, depending on where you put it. You pull it out a little bit, you'll get less bottom end. You put it out here, it's going to be shrill. You know, my favorite default position is about like that. You know, close to the cabinet, and then if it's a little too fizzy, I might move it out a little bit and get a little more air. But then I'll also have like other mics in different positions, and I'll phase align them because it's the sum of multiple sources tends to be, because the components that are in common between the different sources will reinforce. The components that are different, meaning like this speaker is making a certain kind of papery sound, and this speaker is making a different papery sound, they're not the same, so they don't reinforce. Whereas what's in common between the two is going to reinforce. So. That's that answer. And what was your other question?
Acoustic
guitar. Ah, I don't know. Acoustic guitar. Just stick a 414 in the air in front of it. You know, it depends on the acoustic. Because some acoustics are super boomy and woofy. They generate this crazy low end, and you immediately have to get rid of it. And then others are just beautiful and nice. And that's a whole other thing. It's a purely acoustic instrument, and you're thinking of an entirely different thing, really. And it's like I recorded entire records with a 421 with this mic on an acoustic guitar, miking the wood right behind the bridge, because that, for some reason, was the best sound on that guy's guitar. Normally, I'd have a condenser out here. Sorry.
We have one more burning question, then we should call it.
Sure. Okay. So the write-up for this thing mentioned like open versus closed back cabinets.
Yeah, I forgot to bring it up.
That was me writing science fiction.
It was, that's true. But I let it go because it's a good question. Open back cab, okay, the closed back cab, all the frequencies come out the front. Even though you have low end that's kind of going around the corners, it's all coming out the front, more or less as a, you know, a hemisphere kind of thing. An open back, like a twin, a lot of sound goes out the back of the cab. And
it tends to, the low end particularly disperses in a 360-degree manner, whereas the shape of the cone going like this tends to focus the high end out front. So bottom line is your mic is going to get less low end from an open back cab than it's going to pick up from a sealed cab, which is just channeling all that low frequency out the driver. The other thing that makes a big difference is whether your speaker is coupled to the floor. Because if you have a speaker, and say you have a 4x12 and it's up on wheels, you know, the first thing I do in the studio is I flip the thing sideways. So the wheels are sticking out sideways, so the cabinet is coupled to the rug. And then I put a mic there, and you get way more low end out of those bottom two speakers, if that's what you're looking for. You get a lot more bottom end from the speakers when the cabinet is coupled right to the floor without an air gap. As soon as you put it up on an air gap about 2 inches up off the floor with the wheels, that low end kind of goes under the cab, it goes out, it disappears. It's really kind of striking the difference in low end you get with a cab that's up in the air versus... This is why in the studio, people frequently have their monitor speakers up on poles or up on little things that put them up off the monitor bridge, because you're trying to avoid that low frequency kind of buildup that you get off an adjacent surface. But in the case of a guitar amp, you might want that. So same thing with a Fender Twin. It's not getting a lot of bottom end, but if you put it right on the floor, you're going to get more, whereas if it's up on a chair, it's going to sound super thin. So there you go. Got it. The one thing I didn't mention.
Okay.
You better stop.
Thank you. Okay.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for letting me go on.
Thank you, Jack.
My pleasure. I'm sorry I wasn't on the mic the whole time.
It is what it is.
We'll compress it.
Yeah.